This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everybody. And from time to time, I have people who will message me and say, do you mind if we come in? And a week or so ago, I received a message from Lori Lee Oates, and she said, do you mind if I could? And I said, yes. I always enjoy my following guests. Lori Lee Oates, Luke Ashworth, and Steve Tomlin, known as Podco.
Yeah, we're Podco.
You're Podco. And always a rollicking, effervescent conversation with the likes of ye, as we say in Newfoundland.
We're like Codco.
You're like Codco, but
with
PhDs.
Beware of imitations.
And when I say funny, I mean it's still quite funny, but it's kind of dark anyway. I have you in this week, and initially when Lori Lee reached out to me, she said, you want to talk about Trump and what's going on in the States? I said, sure, let's talk about Trump. And then all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, rate mitigation. The rate mitigation plan was put together, or lack thereof, as some might say, came out this week. What do you make of it? I'll put it out there to the room.
Okay, so we know that the PUB came out with kind of a scathing report last week that said that power rates in this province could increase by 75%, and we know that that is unprecedented in the North American experience. The premier has called for $200 million a year to go into rate mitigation in this province, presumably from the federal government. If without that $200 million, we know that rates would go from 13 cents per kilowatt hour to 23 cents per kilowatt hour. The $200 million would keep it more at like the 16, 17 cent rate, which would be in line with what other Canadians are paying. But the premier came out and had a news conference on Monday. He's in a minority government situation. The feds are in a minority situation, and they don't have a written deal. They had an announcement to say we're going to have talks.
The politics around it are horrific. They're playing for different audiences. They're trying to address or deal with a problem which they have inherited, but they're using the same techniques in terms of dealing or addressing that problem. So we have a system where we have two minority governments going behind the scenes. The releasing of this report on a Friday night, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, which is never a good sign, no real opportunity for analysis. The next week they have a big press conference talking about gaining credit, avoiding blame, we've now solved it, which they haven't. They're playing for different audiences. They're trying to convince citizens to vote for them, to support them, that we've actually done something in order to improve conditions and make it possible for people not to be concerned about these higher energy rates. They're playing for the bonding, the financial community. They're also probably talking to the rest of the country because they're trying to convince Canadians that there needs to be support for these conditions, which were the product of kind of self-inflicted wounds or bad decision-making. So this kind of the backroom deals, lack of information, lack of clarity. Citizens don't know what really is on the table or how this is going to work. There's no understanding in terms of the stages. This is a political accord. This is not a legal accord. There's nothing really fully embedded. It doesn't really mean anything opposed to just kind of, having a conversation. So I think, the people who are thinking about financing this or concerned about have financed this in the past are confused. I think other parts of the country are going to be equally confused if the premier can't, define the problem, address that problem, and is having his hand out in order looking for support from the other parts of the country. I think many people in other parts of the country would have no problem helping the citizens of Newfoundland and Labrador, but I don't think they want to give a whole bunch of money to a government, especially given the record in terms of the Muskrat Falls kind of messing up, making bad decisions, not engaging, not basically delivering. And so I think we're really in a horrific place right now, and that's a problem.
You hit the nail on the head, though. You said this is the cause of bad decision making. This isn't a disaster. This isn't circumstances beyond our control. This is the situation we're in now is the result of bad decision making.
It's like the old lady.
Do you think, though, that the rest of government or Canada will support us with that?
It's like the old lady who ate the fly. It's, you know, basically we're spending all of our time trying to fix a problem which is the product of the government doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. That it's, you know, a series of decisions which, in terms of energy and energy planning or lack thereof, lack of information, lack of engagement, lack of opportunity to really understand the full implications of making this really risky decision. And I think it really is compelling for us to understand, recognize that this continues to demonstrate we need democratic reform. The processes don't exist. We're not going through the policy cycle. There isn't evidence gathering. There isn't proper engagement. And at the end of the day, the citizens are paying for it. And if the citizens are paying for it, they're going to be immobilized. But again, if the rest of the country is supposed to pay for this, you have to have some kind of business plan. You know, in the past, when you know Romano was seeking support because the financial sector weren't going to allow the government to really continue, you know, the old ways of decision making, there was you know conditions set. You have to shut hospitals. You have to have a plan in order how you're going to address this. It can't be unconditional. So this again, the challenger problem has to do with the power of premiers to make, even in minority situations, to go behind closed doors, to make these kinds of plans and no, with no real kind of detail. And all of us are suffering as a consequence, and people understand and recognize that.
Everything that we heard, despite what may or may not be going on behind the scenes, felt rushed. The fact that the PUB report was released at 7:30 on a Friday seemed to indicate, oh, we've got to get this out now because this announcement is coming Monday, rather than probably release it on a Monday and then the government's announcement come later on in the week. Was this rushed?
Yes. And realistically, you know, it wasn't worthy of a news conference. It was more worthy of a scrum. You know, but the terrifying thing is we really haven't changed how we make decisions, right? We've still got that executive dominance in the premier's office. The premier still, yeah, I think if anything, he seems to have more control over cabinet and more control over the MHAs than has been the case in the past, right? Executive dominance is increasing and not going away. We do have a democratic reform process. It's been slow to get off the ground, and we're in a minority situation, so it could be gone tomorrow, that, you know, it really hasn't been resourced. And, you know, Sarah Stoodley talked a bit about it yesterday at the conference on our fiscal realities. And, you know, she raised concerns about how the process is going to get paid for, how the changes are going to get paid for. So, you know, but at the same time, it's something we can't afford not to do unless, you know, we want more Muskrat Falls type decisions.
It's amazing when you look at the problem which was constructed or created by how decisions were made in the past and the lack of contestation and evidence gathering and decision making and kind of really economic rationality. And we didn't need the power. And again, the costs were not really you know paid for or made any sense. But we're not having a conversation about that. I mean, it's very clear the problem is executive power. The capacity, the ability for a prime minister in the past with Muskrat Falls and a premier during an election to deliver a project and sell it and control information so the general population is not properly informed. So this kind of hurrah, this campaign, which again, in many respects, is very much like Trump. Evidence doesn't seem to matter. They construct matter or they control the evidence gathering and information gathering. The citizens are only spectators. We can't afford to do that. But you know, if we look at what they're doing currently, rather than recognizing the underlying cause is where power was located and where it needs to be in order to improve decision making. We need processes or mechanisms in play. We need to bring into check the executive power, the control, the manipulation of knowledge of information or lack of information going to the citizens. And we're not seeing any of that. What we're seeing is even the reverse. We're seeing even the continuation of on this track, which has actually brought us to where we are. And if you think about the number of resources that are going into fixing a problem which is actually connected with the lack of democratic reform or the need for democratic reform and the fact that we're not actually having a real conversation aside from let's have a committee, let's have, you know, let's do a little bit. this should be the primary focus. This is a very clear indication that we are in a state of crisis. We have policy failure, and it has to do with where power is located and where it needs to be located in order to basically to improve outcomes for our citizens.
Let's explore that a little bit more coming up right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My guests this afternoon are the triumvirate known as Lori Liotes, Luke Ashworth, and Steve Tomlin. They're with Podco, all with their toes deeply embedded in the political realm here when it comes to analysis and discussion. And just before the break, Steve Tomlin was talking about the concentration of executive power. Has anything changed in our particular government right now, provincially, from when the decisions were being made about Muskrat Falls? And at the time, everybody recognized it. It felt like the whole thing was being pushed forward. Has anything changed?
Well, we had an inquiry, but of course, the timing and the decision and the questions and the hiring, the rest of it laid in the hands of the premier. But we do have that. I mean, that has been, an opportunity to have a bit of a discussion. And we have, a PUB report. And so there have been some things, but whether it is enough or whether where we are currently is sufficient, I think this is really kind of a critical question. Despite some of the things that have been done in the past, it doesn't appear that we have gone very far in terms of coming up with a clear plan and a clear understanding of what the problems are and how to move forward. And again, a lot of that has to do with the continued dominance of the executive branch.
Yeah. Larry Short this morning called the plan a prayer rather than a plan because there are no figures. There's no numbers. There's no breakdown of how this is all going to work. Luke, we haven't heard from you yet.
No, absolutely. I'm the big picture guy, and I suppose the big picture here is that this isn't one crisis and this isn't one problem, but what the rate mitigation issue brings up as well. This is a kind of federal-provincial issue, and one of the things that we are dealing with here is questions about Canadian federalism, and we've kind of walked into the arrangements that we have now. It is linked up also with the issues that both Laurie and Steve have been talking about there about executive dominance, both at the federal and provincial level. It's linked up with issues of fiscal issues as well. In some respects, the provinces are really not fit for purpose for the particularly the smaller provinces in terms of the things that they're being asked to do. And of course, as Steve has talked about in his own work as well, we see this coming out of the election that the kind of federal-provincial relationship is—it's almost like a relationship between sovereign states. It begins to look like a kind of international relations. So we've got this sort of Canadian federal system that's really not fit for purpose. And there's a lot of questions we need to ask here about, do we need to reform Canada as a whole, not just questions around Newfoundland and Labrador.
During the days of Pierre Trudeau was talking about citizens' public policy. He was talking about multilateralism. So he was talking about creating venues in order to promote pan-Canadianism, talking about citizens' issues and problems, but within these larger structures, we've moved away from, we no longer have a national policy. We've seen a decline of pan-Canadian venues and support for programs like Medicare. We've seen a decline in part because of the new logic. We've had even provinces like Newfoundland and Labrador talking about increasing territorial sovereignty, which has resulted in bilateral negotiations as opposed to multilateral negotiations, kind of like Europe.
And so
it's operating like an international system. But as a consequence of that, the premiers are able in a bilateral system to negotiate behind completely, closed doors. They don't have to go to these multilateral forums in order to justify what they're doing or talk about what they're doing, what their priorities are. There's no discussion in terms of moving or working across systems. It's kind of designed to facilitate the center, but negotiating not with all of the kind of the partners, but basically making special deals with different provinces. So different provinces may have different sharing arrangements when it comes to health care funding or different kind of infrastructure projects or the rest of it. So the biggest challenge or problem in terms terms of the current system is that we don't really have the kind of venues that were even limited in the past, and that has increased the power of the executive, the premiers, as they're really operating almost like an international system.
We touched on this before after the last federal election, and we talked about what it is to be Canadian, what the national identity of Canada is, and whether or not federalism, you know, reflects that adequately, and just because of the geographic identity, you know, the whole.
And the other challenge of this is we also don't have a national economy. That for the most part, provinces trade more with outside than they do internally. And so for to a great extent, federalism on top of a political economy, which really isn't a national economy, creates problems.
So is federalism working?
No. particularly fiscal federalism is not working. You know, we're talking about the wrong thing when we're talking about rate mitigation, right? More money should be coming to us through the equalization program. More money should be coming through the Canada Health and Social Transfer. All those federal transfer programs are deeply flawed. And, you know, equalization does not do what it was designed to do in the Constitution Act or British North America Act of 1867. The Canada Health and Social Transfer does not meet the needs of a province with a widespread population, with an aging population. And, you know, you can't even kind of put equalization up there for discussion. The premier kind of buys, you know, the prime minister buys off premiers really quickly, and that just kind of shuts down the discussion. We've seen him buy off Jason Kenney this year. We've seen him buy off Scott Moe. You know, Dwight Ball can't even talk about equalization because he needs a rate mitigation program. And, you know, that goes to exactly what Steve is talking about. A bunch of elites go in a back room and work out these deals between themselves that citizens have no input into, and our federalism and our fiscal transfer programs don't get fixed.
Equalization is an unconditional grant which actually gives more power to premiers. Way back in 1957, when they first launched equalization, many of the premiers, including premiers like W.A.C. Bennett, said, I have no problem subsidizing citizens and taking care of citizens in other jurisdictions. What I don't want to do is I don't want to send Joey Smallwood a whole bunch of money so he can give it to his friends. And so the challenge or problem is there's no conditions applied. So if it's an unequal... if it's an unconditional grant and premiers now have access to more resources in order to do what they want, not only do they have more capacity to fight Ottawa or bash Ottawa because they have more independence, but they can do whatever they want with it. And so again, Muskrat Falls or many energy projects across the country would probably, by themselves, would never happen. But in a federal context, this idea that, well, it doesn't matter anyway because this is kind of free money. This is unconditional money. We're fighting in terms of these energy grids that we're building. So the challenge or problem is the citizens don't matter. I mean, this is designed, equalization is not designed to, some of the programs initially were supposed to share and help, you know, in terms of pensions and the Medicare and the rest of it. But there are critical problems in terms of the way fiscal federalism is designed. It's designed for territoriality. It's designed to give power to premiers as opposed to the citizens. And so we need a combination of federal reform, but we also need fundamental democratic reform. We need both.
Mm-hmm. Further to your point about citizens don't matter, the whole notion of Muskrat Falls at the time seemed to come from nowhere. The lesson to be learned, I suppose, is that where there's political will, things can happen. But it seems to me that it wasn't driven by anything the citizens wanted. It was an idea that was pie in the sky for ever so long, and somebody decided that now's the time.
Well, it was built on the notion that the demand for electricity was going to be increasing in the province, and that doesn't look to be the case anymore. And going back to citizens, right, the lowest income people are going to be the hardest hit by rising electricity rates because it becomes a greater portion of their income that's paid out for electricity. And also, we've got to remember, we pay HST on electricity. So that's money being sent outside the province, right?
The hydro development goes back to the Ontario kind of, you know, the initiative in the 1920s, 1930s, this idea of province building, creating the controlling and protecting the border. Border boundary, creating the conditions for the manufacturing conditions. So Ontario, despite the fact people often think Quebec or BC or Alberta or whatever were the drivers of the original model in terms of province building, energy, the production of energy, particularly hydro, whether it's British Columbia, Manitoba, Newfoundland and Labrador, or Quebec, or even initially in terms of early Ontario history, was all about defending the border or boundary. It was about enhancing trade north and south. It was about constructing kind of energy grids or systems which would facilitate and add to the power of premiers and build these kind of very powerful provincial states. So that's part of, part of the federal story, where we start off by design highly centralized, but now we're now the most decentralized. And part of it had to do kind of some of these various initiatives which took place. So hydro, in many respects, is not just about providing energy. It's about identity. It's about having control, about your own destiny, whether you're in Quebec, whether you're in Ontario, whether you're in British Columbia. And this kind of sense that it doesn't matter what the costs are. I mean, W.I.C. Bennett didn't care about the cost of and the logic in terms of Two Rivers policy, that he had the right as a premier to do what he needed to do in order to defend and protect the interests of British Columbia, to defend the borders and boundaries, to make sure that the activity, the development was occurring within that particular unit. And so a lot of the hydro is not about citizens. It's not really about what is the most effective form of energy production or management or infrastructure. What are the costs? That never comes up. What comes up is kind of a source of power. It's about increasing the power. It's about controlling those borders or boundaries. And in Canada, we've really been, compromised by this ongoing battle between energy sectors, which are tied to state building, provincial state building.
Yeah, it's a toxic relationship, basically.
Lori Lee Oates, Luke Ashworth, and Steve Tomlin, collectively known as Podco, are my in-studio guests this afternoon. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. So deep in conversation there during the break that I missed my cue. We were talking rather intensively about these level 3 charging stations. And my question during the break was, is it not the entrepreneurial community's responsibility to set these things up and see a business opportunity here? Or is it government's responsibility? And Luke, you had some thoughts on
that. Yeah, I mean, the problem is there's not all economies are the same, not all jurisdictions are the same. And there are certain situations. If you've got a very rich, very densely populated part of the world, heavily urban, then leaving that up to companies who are looking out for making profits it can often be a very good move. The problem is, what do you do with areas where you have very sparse population, maybe in very underdeveloped, maybe a resource-based economy, where profit margins are going to be small or next to nothing? They're going to need the infrastructure built in. Then it usually is the role of governments, and that's why, of course, poorer parts of the world, poorer parts of, for example, areas of the north of England or northern Scandinavia, Atlantic Canada, outside the major urban areas, you do tend to get a heavier government involvement in the economy because the public sector can't do it. There's limits to what the private sector can't do it. The limit to what the private sector can do.
And I think there is huge challenges and questions in terms of what is the appropriate role for the state in terms of making these kinds of investments. I mean, people in Newfoundland and Labrador are talking about, well, wait till 2041. I mean, 2041 is a long ways away. In the United States, we were talking earlier before we were online. In the United States, they don't rely upon the government to the same extent. There's kind of this kind of sense that there's alternative forms of energy and they're competing with one another. And they do, they can or deal with things like the climate crises or climate change. You can actually build it in terms of your regulations. But in Canada, we have, whether it's the national policy, the third national policy, whether it's many of the provincial governments, they tie everything to their investments in terms of infrastructure. So rather than talking about what form of energy makes the most sense, or even the role of the private sector in terms of filling the gaps which have been created because of the problems of the government. So having people in the private sector responding to the fact we have too much electricity, is that really the most appropriate approach to making economic decisions? I mean, the business will respond to crises and take Muskrat Falls created business opportunities. There are people who made probably fortunes as a result of the calculations of the risky behavior on the part of government. But again, we need to have a real conversation in terms of how should we be making decisions? What should be the most appropriate appropriate role for the state? Should it be kind of the Danny Williams as opposed to Roger Grimes approach in terms of the role of the state? So we need that really larger conversation. Do we really want to make these kinds of investments? Do we? And if we want to make transformation, which I think, for example, we haven't talked a lot about climate change, that's inevitable that we have to make and transition and create the conditions and prepare for that, as opposed to kind of looking for the next energy source, which I think is probably problematic and has created all kinds of problems because the risks are paid for by citizens, and many of the decisions are more political than policy informed.
Can I just add to that as well? I mean, one of the things I think we've noticed about the debates about where we should be going, which require knowledge from all sorts of different sectors, it's kind of sort of been shunted off into two bubbles, and I think we've seen this with the kind of the government narrative you've got a kind of a group that talk about the economy, talk about fiscal problems, but they do it in isolation from major political economic things that are happening around the world, ecological issues, decarbonization, climate emergency. And then you have a kind of a debate amongst particularly civil society groups, scientists and so forth. People are looking at more sort of global issues, and they have a completely different debate. And what's fascinating is that certainly in this province, those kind of debates occur in two separate bubbles. So there's no discussion about how climate change, decarbonization, and the Saudi decision to keep pumping oil is going to have an effect on our fiscal situation, which relies upon oil maintaining or even growing in profit in terms of sort of dollars per barrel. So you know we need that kind of joined up thinking, and again,
We need more pluralism,
and it comes back to democratic reform, getting more diverse voices into politics. But it's also about kind of executive dominance, because one of the things about executive dominance is you control the information that's coming in. So it's about information control as well.
In the United States, you have different energy sectors competing with one another. You need to put them all in the same room. You need to talk about the climate. You need to, for the most part, we operate in silos, and it doesn't make development and climate have to be interconnected. They are interconnected. You can't just do one and think, well, there's no impacts in terms of the other. We need to have all those different voices within the same room.
You can't talk about the economy and not talk about decarbonization.
But that sounds like a room that's full of older white men to me, right? And yesterday we had a conference on the economy, and I'd say the average age in the room was probably 60. It was overwhelmingly white men.
I'm 65.
That doesn't make it any better. And, you know, a lack of women on the agenda. Yeah. We didn't have a speaker talking about climate change. We didn't have a speaker talking about decarbonization. So, you know, there's lots of room to make improvements here.
That's it, Laurie.
If you stop anybody on the street and you ask them, you know, what do you think about Muskrat Falls, their responses are going to be very different. Some will be talking about the economic impact. Some will be talking about the environmental impact. Some will be saying it's a great idea for decarbonization. Others will be saying, well, what about, the food and the land that people are living and consuming food from? You know, there are so many aspects to this and so many opinions.
It all comes down to power.
I think the overwhelming legacy of Muskrat Falls is that it's made people in this province hate both of the major parties. And a lot of the discussion right now goes around, we've got to get rid of parties in this province.
We have to figure out where power lies. We need to know where it needs to lie in order to improve decision making. So,
and how do we wrest the control back? We are the bosses here.
We have to begin promoting, contesting power to get those kinds of reforms. If women are important in terms of decision making, we need to create the conditions and provide the resources to ensure that they actually are in charge or in
at the table.
Green energy. I mean, a lot in the United States, people don't care in the private sector about really any of this stuff. They want to make a profit. You create the conditions where, because of the needs of the public and the earth, you need to create the conditions where they have no other choice but to operate, where the green energy itself becomes the economy. And you need to have a conversation. And once they buy into it, once you create charter rights, once you mobilize and give power to women or people with disabilities or what have you, that changes the whole game. So they don't have to fight to get to the table. They're at the table. We need public policy forums. We need to create the resources. We need the knowledge networks in order to give those people who are not part of the conversation a place at the table. So we need to have a discussion in terms of democratic reform, federal reform, so we're focusing on citizens. So we're talking about charter rights. We're talking about the environment. And for the most part, the system's is not designed that way. So we need to have those underlying. But the fact that we're not doing that, the fact that we have premiers and the national government trying to basically just to fix the system to sustain it, as opposed to understanding and recognizing that many of the challenges and problems have to do with the lack of voice and the fact that citizens are spectators, I think we need to have that conversation.
Will Muskrat Falls ever be successful for us? Will it ever work?
I think Muskrat Falls is going to look better and better as we get more and more serious about climate change, as people transition off oil and gas and into electricity, and as electric cars come along, right? And you already mentioned
we may be bankrupt by then.
The premier says we're not going bankrupt, and he's not wrong, right? We don't have we do have a lot of assets, and we have a lot of tax capacity that is not being utilized, which came up yesterday at our conference on the economy. $500 million in income tax revenue, $350 to $400 million in municipal tax revenue.
Now, people might argue with that. What do you mean?
Okay, so this comes from a presentation that the department head of political science, Russell Williams, made yesterday. He's a political economist. I think he specializes in fiscal federalism. Yep. And so basically, there's a lot of people in this province who do not pay municipal taxes, mostly outside the census metropolitan area. And our income tax was lowered by Premier Williams, which is over more than a decade ago now, and it put it below Atlantic Canadian rates, right? We still pay some of the lowest income tax in Atlantic Canada, even though we have the highest incomes in Atlantic Canada. And what happened in 2016 was a lot of the burden was put on low-income earners with consumption taxes, right, like book taxes and gas taxes and insurance taxes, right, which is the most regressive kind of taxation that there is, whereas income tax goes on medium and high-income earners. But right now, that tax capacity is being left on the table in this province.
Laurie and Luke talk about this a lot. And the good thing, the thing that we can benefit from Muskrat Falls is understanding and recognizing it's an opportunity that learn from the policy failure. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the Second World War. You know, people saying this is unacceptable, and these kind of borders and boundaries and all these kind of crazy ideas, and the costs are horrific. So we need to actually have European integration. We need to think about public policy and create multilateral ways of decision making and change identities and just basically come together in a logical way. Laurie often talks about things which happen in Europe and Paris we're having in terms of debt. So this is an opportunity. But it's an opportunity that will be wasted if we don't have the leadership and the understanding that the problems themselves have it to how with decisions and how they have been made or how they should be made. And so for me, Muskrat Falls, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of frustration. We need to understand and recognize there's an opportunity for powerful leadership, the building of a coalition, the coming together, comparable to climate change, the climate crises, and so on. And so again, in Europe, that was the lesson. And there were benefits.
Until Brexit.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. And also, I think underlying all of this is the issue of the necessity of change. Quite often, the status quo is fine if you all think that everything is kind of good the way it is and we should preserve it. But let's face it, we've been in austerity now for 5 years. Memorial University has been cut for the last 7 years. We're basically, to use a term from Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek economist, we're in debtor's prison.
We're penny wise and pound foolish.
We are as well. Yeah, exactly. But we're in debtor's prison. if you're happy with that and you're happy living in a state of constant austerity, then the status quo is for you. So otherwise, though, we've got to make major changes.
Well, what's the answer to this millstone? that we all have around our collective next.
Well, I mean, I think it has to be a combination of things. And one of the things that we really should be, and it's interesting that they had this conference on the fiscal crisis and it kept going back to democratic reform. One of the issues is democratic reform. And it's not just because it's nice to live in a democratic society. It's also because democracy is about knowledge flows. Democracy is about diversity of opinions. And we need to get those knowledge flows going. We've kind of got ourselves in the... it's not just in Newfoundland and Labrador, and it's not just in Canada, but it's very much clearly this is happening here. We need to get kind of diverse representations and diverse discussions about what the hell we are going to do.
And
in that
static.
Sense, it's very similar to what Steve is talking about.
And if you think about what happened in Germany in the post-war era, or what happened in Japan, or you think about Newfoundland and Labrador coming into this country in 1949, the incredible improvements or changes which occurred in a very short period of time. So, despite the fact that Germany was in a kind of state of crisis and there was lack of infrastructure, I mean, the conditions were horrific in the post-war era, but Germany turned itself around very quickly, in part because it reformed its federal system, it reformed its democratic system. It is a kind of the center of innovation and the rest of it. Japan doesn't have natural resources. It's basically knowledge and innovation and improvement and the rest of it. So there is hope, but we need to understand and recognize we can't do things the way we've done in the past. We have to have fewer kind of behind room, backroom deals where only a few benefit, where there's no analysis and no investigation. We need to engage. We need to be part of this kind of larger conversation. And for the most part, we're not getting that.
And democracy is an evolution. It's not static. It doesn't in place. Society changes. Everything changes.
It's a process. But, it's of value in the sense of all the things we've been talking about, in the sense that we need to get people together with different knowledge bases to solve these problems. We are not solving them at the moment by this kind of sort of executive management of what knowledge is accepted and what isn't.
We're overdue for the break. We'll be back right after this. Our guests this afternoon, the three members of PODCO, Lori Lee Oates, Luke Ashworth, and Steve Tomlin.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
Man, Kerry Hodder is going to be slapping my wrist today because I'm not paying attention and I'm having too much fun, I guess, is the problem here. But that's a good thing. That's a good problem to have. We've only got a few minutes left because I went overdue for the last break. But the budget, we've got the upcoming budget. I saw Tom Osborne the other day. He had a big smile on his face. He's planting trees, Lori Lee.
Okay.
What can we expect?
So, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying about being penny wise and pound foolish, right? And we're already getting feelers that they're going to be cut in the university. Now, we just had a news story about how many international students come into the province because of the university. You could create a municipality the size of Portugal Cove, St. Phillips, right? The university is an asset that brings people here, brings scholars here, people who pay high taxes to the province, but yet that's something that the government has consistently cut. We need, pretty much to double the staff in the immigration department because we need to double our immigration in this province, and that hasn't been done. We need the Newfoundland Statistics Agency bumped up because we need evidence-based decision-making. We need a parliamentary budget officer to be proactive in managing our costs. But none of those kinds of things get funded because all it is cut, 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 and austerity really doesn't work, has been shown time and time again by economists.
So what's the solution?
To be more strategic. I mean, if you look at the way forward, it doesn't even mention the service economy, right? Like, we have like the best writers in the world here, but we're not developing a publishing sector. We have the best musicians. We're not developing a music sector. We're cutting the university when we should be using it to create innovation and grow innovation and build knowledge sectors. The tech economy is growing by 20%, the government likes to talk about. The tech economy grew by 2%. 200% globally in the last decade. You know, so we're really not, we've never moved off the imperial economy. This government likes the imperial economy because it brings royalty revenues to them, which they have all the control over. It gives the corporations that bring those royalties to the province all the control over our government. And, you know, we've never really moved into the global economy.
And that's what we learned yesterday at the conference, that Nova Scotia is doing a lot better job, again, developing the competencies, having the strategy, having the skill sets required in order to attract people. And their population is growing, and their economy, again, is more diversified. And I think we are trapped to a certain extent by some of these old past dependencies.
We tend to be reactionary. We don't often lead the way. Why is that? Is that because of our history of
well, we've
dependence?
Got the people here. Like Luke always says that, you know, if we were a corporation, we'd be ripe for takeover because we've got a great workforce, right? And you'd get us cheap. But we're really not taking advantage of the brilliant people we've got in this province. We've got the best musicians. We've got the best actors, the best comedians, the best writers. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, the problem is not the people. The problem is our government that is stuck in this 19th century model of economics.
We have a lot of experts, people who know a hell of a lot about a hell of a lot. But this is the point, that knowledge is not being accessed when we make political and economic decisions. And I think that's the real big problem.
We have incredible talent, but we also have a strong sense of identity and community, which doesn't exist in other places like Alberta. And so,
and resilience.
And many of the divisions are just artificial, created divisions by the politics or by how the system is organized. Or not, and how it should be organized. Because again, as Laurie says, we have so much capacity, we have so much ability within civil society, but this is not being tapped.
Stephen Harper will always be remembered in this province for saying we had a culture of defeat, but that's very far removed from the reality. We have
Absolutely.
A very resilient population. We wouldn't have been here for hundreds of years if that were not the case. So why this disconnect between
elected
officials and the rest of us.
We welcomed the world, and we executed with military precision. And that is part of the global conversation right now. We're an example of how to welcome people when the rest of the world is putting up borders. And that is what's wrong with what Stephen Harper said. But we need to know that about ourselves. We need to know that we are a global example, and the rest of the world
Absolutely.
Is looking to us.
It's not a problem with the people. It's a problem with the institutions. And it's about institutional reform, political reform, democratic reform. There's a lot of very good talent in this province.
But we also need to make sure we don't cut the venues or the capacity in order to improve or bring about transformation. So MUN, for example, is a very active institution, very much embedded within the community, and we bring together community and expert knowledge. And part of the reason probably it's being cut is because people in positions of power probably don't like that, because we do contest, and we do contest power, and we do try to mobilize.
So just under 2 minutes left. Final thoughts?
I mean, I think, there's a big disconnect between the discussion I saw yesterday and, say, the discussion I saw at Green New Drinks when Jody Wilson-Raybo was in town and Jane Philpott. Mm. And, you know, like, they, you could tell they were clearly impressed by the energy in the room. And this is the democratic reform capital of Canada right now. People are mobilizing for change here. And we've got to remember we're ahead of the rest of the world on this at a time when government is in crisis globally.
That's a good way to finish up, I think.
Indeed. Well, I mean, the coming weeks and months are going to tell a few tales, including the budget, which we don't have a date on that yet, but traditionally comes down mid-March-ish. I think that might be pushed back a little bit.
After the feds.
So it'll be very interesting to see, with especially the minority government situation. A lot of people saying that this is going to be a good news budget. Should it be a good news budget? We have the possibility of two leadership reviews coming up for the PCs and the Liberals. Will those two leaders meet the test, and will they continue on? Could we be looking at another provincial and or federal election in the not-too-distant future? So there's lots to talk about.
And the people need to keep energized and keep hope and keep pushing.
But don't let the snow get you down. Make the most of it. Get out there. Once this cleanup is finished, get out there, buy a pair of snowshoes or something, and have fun. That's all I can say. I think this whole winter is getting to everybody right now. I want to thank my guests, Lori Lee Oates, Luke Ashworth, and Steve Tomlin for coming in. Interesting as always. Hope to have you in again sometime soon. And tomorrow we're going to have members of the Alliance for the Control of Tobacco in to talk about vaping. Let's stay tuned for that.